Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you very much for joining us. Our guests are Steve McDonald of Channel 2 News, Sean Dugan of Channel 11 News, and from Juneau, Rebecca Braun of the Alaska Budget Report. Sean, you have some breaking news on Point Thompson, perhaps the gas line, and certainly Governor Sean Parnell's efforts to get all of them moving.
Well, I think breaking information would be a better way of putting it. What it means, who knows, because as some may remember, we have been here before with Governor Murkowski. But today, Governor Parnell announced, along with Commissioner Dan Sullivan, that they had reached alignment with the major oil producers. You may recall Governor Parnell said he wanted to see alignment by the 31st. Looks like he got it in under the wire. A lot of people have been expecting this. Yesterday, a judge agreed to dismiss the Point Thompson lawsuit, which has been dragging on for years, and many people believe this to be part of the deal. For the record, Governor Parnell today said it has nothing to do with the ongoing debate about oil taxes as far as the timing. Simply the economics. So what it means, we're not sure yet. There's no indication as to where the line would go. It would be an in-state line to Tidewater, whether that means Valdez or Cook Inlet, nobody knows. And as far as how Point Thompson ties into it, well, you need Point Thompson to fill up any line because that's where the gas is. So I'm sure there will be those out there that say that this is the part of the governor's effort to move along what was once called House Bill 110, his version of the oil tax cuts. How this will tie into that, what kind of commitments they're getting and what kind of commitments they need on that end, it's all still playing out. Actually, the press conference just began about 11 o'clock. So,
okay, and we are recording at noon on Friday. Rebecca, tensions are growing over the oil taxes as the legislature and the governor, or the Senate and the governor, are increasingly at odds. But first of all, do you have anything you want to add to what you just heard from Sean, or should we go right to the legislature?
We can just go right into the legislature.
All right, please do.
What's that?
Please do. Tell us what you saw this week.
Well, the oil tax is sort of grinding on, and right now I would say in the building, in the Senate Finance Committee, legislators are deep in the weeds. It's Excel charts and colorful graphs and pages and pages and pages of PowerPoint presentations. It seems, though, that the larger debate remains the same, and in some ways that debate was taking place outside the Capitol this week, where the governor had his Make It Meaningful rally, and Senator Gary Stevens, the Senate president, gave a speech to the Juneau Chamber of Commerce yesterday where he really kind of reframed the debate from the Senate's perspective and explained why they're holding out and have such a different view than the governor does. So I would say, in short, nothing has really changed right now. We're waiting for a bill, and most likely next week something will come out of the Senate Finance Committee, and it will, I think, be something much less than what the House and the governor want in terms of the give to industry, much more in line with what the Senate's been saying, that we just want to lower the tax rates at the top somewhere, very high oil prices.
Thank you, Rebecca. Steve McDonald, make it meaningful, and you better make it meaningful on this show.
The pressure's on.
Yeah.
I should say something like make it $2 billion or something like that, because I think that's what we're talking about with money anyways, in terms of what it would cost the state in revenue. Yeah, it was a rally. It said make it meaningful. You had former Governor Tony Knowles, who was there.
About 1,200 people, I was told.
A lot of folks, a lot of noise, a lot of pomp and circumstance, and you said loud rock music and things like that, so it sounded like it was meaningful. But this, I think, is one of the problems with this whole debate is what is your definition of meaningful? What's meaningful?
Well, they had a handout there that had a variety of points on it, the sponsors of the meaningful rally.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the question I had is, okay, Governor, you got your point of view here. Are you willing to entertain other points of view? It seems like unconditional surrender is the request here.
I don't think, yes, I think that's what it is. One side they want it all. The Senate wants it all. They have cast themselves as the adult in the room when it comes to these negotiations. They, you know, lucky for the state, we're here keeping an eye on the House and the governor because they want to give everything away, and we're being the responsible adults here. So I think that's the House. That's what the Senate has kind of cast itself. The governor is saying, you know, we've got to make some changes because we're losing production each and every month, basically, from the North Slope, and we've got to change the tax regime. Obviously, this is the debate that's been playing out for months and months and months now. So I think we're not going to see anything move until we get down to the last days of the session. Even then, I don't think it's going to happen. I think the lawmakers are going to have to ask themselves, you know, I'm going to clear my calendar for September because I'm probably still going to be in Juneau. Because I think the governor's leverage here is going to be about calling special sessions and applying the pressure there.
Sean, I threw the question I was going to ask to Steve.
Steve did a great job.
Oh, sorry, did I go on?
I'll call you Steve.
That's okay.
What can you add here about the possibilities?
Well, and I agree with Steve. The governor has been kind of, to use a term, hell-bent for leather, at least for HB 110, and the amount of money he wants to get, the billions versus hundreds of millions that the Senate is talking about. And it seems like from the governor's perspective, what we've seen from him is not really negotiations on, okay, we don't have to go down to 20% on the tax. Maybe a couple hundred million is better than nothing. Basically, the governor's take has been, well, if we get everything that we're asking for from our office, then the oil companies will do X, Y, and Z. And recently, he's thrown out numbers like $5 billion in investment by the oil companies, saying that would come after meaningful tax changes. But we really haven't seen the governor throw out numbers that are different from the numbers he's been talking about for the last 2 years. It seems his leverage is going to be things like today with Point Thompson and the gas line. And with that in the mix, I really don't know if that speeds up or slows down any momentum to make tax changes to ACES.
Rebecca, I have only read the news accounts of Gary Stevens' speech. I've yet to get online and read the actual text. But from what was reported, it seemed like he went very far out of his way to be careful, to be measured, to be restrained, and to advocate prudence, and to some degree was casting Sean Parnell, of all people, as a riverboat gambler. What do you make of this?
Well, I think in some ways, you know, that's Gary Stevens' temperament. He's very sort of good-natured and measured, and in some ways he's going out of his way because the governor has been a few times, I would say, pretty aggressive toward the Senate. And recently, he wrote that letter comparing the senators to hens in the barnyard clucking over an egg. And, you know, Gary Stevens came back and just made a bunch of egg jokes and didn't express any kind of animosity toward the governor. And what he said yesterday was really pointing out, of course, what Governor Hickel and Governor Hammond would have said. And he says they didn't necessarily agree on much, but they agreed on this to get the value out of our resources. He invoked Ronald Reagan, you know, trust but verify, as far as what the industry says they're going to do. And he did a little math pointing out that even if we do get this $5 billion in new investment, it would be over a whole number of years where we would probably give away some $18 billion. So he laid out not exactly a new case, but he certainly put together, I think, all the arguments senators have been made in his kind of affable, good-natured way. And he said, just like education, and it's probably no coincidence he used this comparison because the governor and the House have been very critical of educators recently, always asking for more money. He says, well, just as educators are always asking for more, the oil industry will always say they want more too, and that we shouldn't necessarily just give it to them because they say they want it.
And of course, in the case of Gary Stevens, he's speaking as a former teacher, so he knows about education. Rebecca, following up, is Governor Parnell's struggle with the Senate leadership apt to spill over and influence the fate of other legislation that's before the Senate?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly that seemed to happen last year, where there was an epic struggle over the capital budget between the Senate and the governor. And We'll see. We're seeing a struggle over House Bill 104 right now, which is the governor's bill to set up this endowment for his Alaska Performance Scholarship. And it seems almost like not that big of a bill, but that's become a source of tension where senators are writing in some slightly different requirements. They're making a path where a student could graduate high school with a GED and still be eligible for the scholarship. And the governor's been kind of digging his heels in on that. So we're seeing it spill over a little bit, though I don't think it's anything new. I think there are genuine ideological differences, and those are playing out in across the board.
Once again, I'm Michael Carey. I'm here with Steve McDonald, Sean Dugan, and Rebecca Braun. The Anchorage municipal election campaign enters its final stages. Tuesday's election day. Sean, what do you see in the final days?
Well, it's really heating up. You know, as you can expect, the guy in second place, Paul Honeyman, is really trying to apply pressure to the incumbent, Mayor Dan Sullivan. We are taping this on Friday. He's having a press conference today. He was on the KAKM program Running last night talking about the port, and he's trying to draw connect the dots to back to the mayor with all the problems that the port's been having with its expansion project. He's going to have a press conference later today to try and vet that out. I think the most recent poll, though, showed him polling pretty far behind Mayor Dan Sullivan. So, you know, he says, as a lot of people that are coming in second place in the polls say, you know, give me if it, I would prefer to have another month, you know, just a little more time and maybe I could catch up. It'd be interesting to see if he will. He's also recently come out on the side of Proposition Number 5, which is really divisive. That mirrors the same ordinance Dan Sullivan vetoed a few years ago. So he's trying to see if he can, you know,
the so-called gay rights proposal.
Absolutely. And that the recent polls show that having about 50% approval. So he's, you know, I think he's trying to grab some of those voters. Whether that will happen or not remains to be seen.
Steve, on Prop 5, the advertising war has really heated up, and now both sides are holding press conferences and availabilities to complain.
Yeah. Just a few weeks ago, Michael, we were talking about how the vote yes on Prop 5 group had about $220,000 in its campaign war chest, while the folks who were fighting the proposition had about $25,000. And in the last couple of weeks, a lot of money has poured into both campaigns, and some of it from outside sources as well. So that's really fueled quite a bit of this now. And I think we all could have predicted
we did
a month ago that it was going to get like this, right? Yeah, I guess we did, but it has.
Right.
Yeah, it was a pretty easy one, but it was it has gotten nasty. I think there's a lot of misinformation that's going out there as well, and I think that was probably the fear of both sides that things were going to get overblown, and the fear factor would come into play here, and voters sometimes when they get confused or maybe frightened of something, they'll, you know, they'll vote a certain way and give that reaction. We'll see what happens on Tuesday.
Sean, I wanted to ask you a question about we talked at one point about polling in this, and then apparently, according to a Dave Dittman pollers, about 9 or 10% of the people are undecided on Prop 5. Is that what it is?
8%. Yeah.
Okay. I'm wondering if, given the intensity of how the general public feels about that, if that's apt to be accurate, or it's just people don't want to talk to pollsters about this subject.
Well, I've long contended that polls, especially in this market, are a dangerous thing, especially when you're trying to count the conservative vote. I think they're more likely to just not answer the polls. So, but it's difficult, as you say, after the what some called the summer of hate, or the summer where AO 64 was debated, the ordinance that was vetoed by Mayor Sullivan. It's difficult to understand that after that and all the ads and all the talk about Prop 5 that there would be people out there who are still undecided on this. But, you know, it's one of those issues that there's a lot of different angles on this as far as why you might support it or why you might oppose it. And there are people who say, well, they support the idea, but they oppose the language. There are other people on the other side of that. So the bottom line is we'll see.
Watch television or listen to the radio Tuesday night. Steve, briefly.
Yeah. The key to this whole thing is going to be voter turnout. Which side gets their folks out to vote? Who's the best motivator? And that's the key.
Rebecca, I'm going to skip ahead to get you in here. The Kibata officials, the officials charged with building and getting the financing for the Knik Arm Crossing, came to Juneau last week, and they ran into some stormy crossings themselves. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, the Kabata guys didn't have a great day on Monday in Senate Finance. Senator Linda Menard has a bill in, and there's a companion over in the House, that would basically set up a fund. And this fund would essentially be there, once it's capitalized, to subsidize operations of the bridge for the first, they estimate, 7 or 8 years. That's one of the main things that the bill does. Now, of course, this is just what the opposition wanted to hear. They've been pouncing on this and saying, you promised us it wasn't going to take any more state money, and now you're admitting that it is not going to, tolls are not going to cover the state's required payments to this as yet unnamed kind of hoped for private builder and operator. They're not going to cover the payments for 7 or 8 years, and they're asking for $150 million to be set aside to cover those payments. So, but I think, you know, fundamentally the debate is sort of still the same, but Senator Stedman, who was chairing the meeting in Senate Finance, was very critical of the presentation. And after the hearing, I said to him, what's your plan for the bill? Because it was held in committee. And he just looked me in the eye, he's kind of deadpan, and said, not much. And the sort of probably most dramatic moment of the hearing was the last moment when Senator Dennis Egan from Juneau was looking at the literature that Kabata had put out, and it's on their website too, although perhaps this bit has been taken down by now. But there was a historic photo on there, and the caption on the photo, and I believe the caption might have been historic as well, said, this is the view you will see on your drive to the Capitol in Willow. So Senator Egan read that sentence aloud, and then he just looked at them and he said, that offends me. And before they could say anything or even stammer out an apology, Senator Stedman dropped the gavel and adjourned the meeting. So that was the final point of the meeting. All in all, it didn't go very well. The public never did get a chance to testify. Some people were frustrated. I knew some people who wanted to testify against it, and they were a bit frustrated, but I said, don't worry about it. I think Senator Stedman's idea might have been to give the Kabata guys enough rope and let them hang themselves, which seemed to be what happened on Monday. But you never know. That bill's certainly not dead.
This may be a first, a devastating cut line that undermines legislation. Quite something. Sean, a Coney abduction case goes on and on of the barista who has disappeared and it still has not been found. There was an arrest in Texas. Many viewers, listeners, members of our community are having a hard time putting this all together, and the officials, the police departments, are not saying much.
No, they're not. And they say that they're not going to say anything, and then they release a little bit of information, which makes things more confusing. The main point of contention here, I think, is obviously we have a guy, Israel Keys, a local contractor. He's cooling his heels now at the Anchorage Correctional Center. It's where all the federal inmates go here in Alaska. There's a contract there. He has been charged with access device fraud, which means he used somebody's debit card to withdraw more than a couple $1,000, I think it is. It's a felony. But they've always said he is connected to the Samantha Koenig abduction. The card does not belong to Samantha Koenig. Her father says it does not belong to him. The police have never said whose debit card it was that he was using. So the connection's pretty tenuous. It's difficult to understand how he could be connected to the case and not charged. Interestingly also, he is going to be arraigned on charges of access device fraud, but there's
That's
no...
That's federal.
That is. This is all a federal case, but they haven't charged him with anything in relation to the Samantha Koenig abduction. They recently held a press conference with the FBI, the U.S. Marshals, and APD, where they showed pictures of his truck. They still asked for public's help in getting information. That would seem to indicate that they still lack a lot of clues in this case.
But on the other hand, it's not really unusual for prosecutors and the police to charge somebody with lesser charges and get them in jail while they work on the bigger charges.
Well, and absolutely, and we all assume that's what's going on here, but the whole point is they haven't connected the dots on how he's connected to the abduction. They just recently admitted, I think 2 days ago during their press conference, that they believe he is the main person involved, and they won't say if there's others, but they don't have any, no one else has been arrested. It doesn't appear that APD has any other persons of interest or the FBI. So the connection to Samantha Koenig is still it's still unclear, and I think that's really the problem most people have.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, but if I remember correctly, his record is not one that contains violence.
Nope. Actually, we've done a pretty thorough search on that, and all that we could come up with was a DUI that he received while he was stationed, I believe, at Fort Lewis, Washington in the military. But otherwise, it's pretty unremarkable. And also on that, he doesn't seem to have left a lot of digital footprints. You know, in today's day and age, when you sign up for something, you leave a footprint out there, and he's a person who seems to have been living here for a number of years, but really, strangely enough, there's not a lot of evidence he's been around.
Steve.
Yeah, well, just the only thing to add to that, I think Sean's right on with a lot of what he said. Police, FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office, they say they're not giving out a lot of details simply because they want to make sure that the information that they get back from people that they're questioning, is information that only they would know, that it's not something that they've put out on TV, put out on a website or a newspaper, and given people opportunities to read about that and maybe recite that back to them. So they want to make sure that the information is definitely is fresh and new information that no one would know.
Okay, thank you. Let's turn back to Rebecca. Rebecca, the House passes a bill to develop a natural gas pipeline, a small one, from the North Slope to South Central Alaska. The measure would cost some $7.5 billion, or up to that amount, and would be put together, the pipeline would be put together by HFC. This is something that's rattled around in the House for a while now, and it's out there and on its way to the Senate, but it didn't get much of an enthusiastic reception so far beyond the House floor. What can you tell us?
Well, this is another bill that the Senate has a lot of trepidation about. So I don't think it will come out of the Senate, if it comes out at all, in the same form that it left the House. The Senate in particular is very nervous about, although this bill doesn't directly obligate the state for $7.5 or $8 billion for this pipeline that they hope gets built. The Senate says, well, Senator Stedman has said, the further we go down this path and we get people's hopes up, and then, you know, if the private sector doesn't show up, there's going to be a lot of pressure on the state to pay. And Senator Stedman has said repeatedly, where's private industry? Why aren't they showing up if this is such a good idea? And others have pointed out, as the minority did in the House, that this is likely to be very expensive gas, that there's such pressure to build it, that it's not necessarily going to provide such cheap gas. So there are a lot of unanswered questions remaining about the bill, and the House minority was pretty close to unanimous in their opposition, and I think the Senate majority tends to share some of those views.
Okay, let's finish up with you, Rebecca, by turning to House Bill 80, Representative Mark Newman's Stand Your Ground bill, which has received a mixed reception in the Senate, and especially in the context it's now in, the Trayvon Martin shooting in Florida.
Well, interestingly, that bill, House Bill 80 by Mark Newman, passed the House last year, and it has 12 Senate cross sponsors, and that's 12 out of 20. So in theory, that bill should sort of fly through the Senate. And it did move out of the one potential, really biggest potential for bottleneck, which was Senate Judiciary, which is chaired by Senator Hollis French. He is a Democrat and a former prosecutor, and he himself says he opposes the bill, but that he wouldn't block its movement out of his committee. So it moved from the committee a couple weeks ago after some pretty compelling testimony, really on both sides. There were a lot of individual Alaskans and the NRA pushing for the bill. And the idea, they say, is essentially they fear unfair prosecution, that it the current law, they think, doesn't protect people who might need to use deadly force to save or defend themselves or their family. Just to back up, the current law does allow people to use deadly force in cases of self-defense in their own home, in the workplace, or a place where they've been, a home they've been invited to, and in certain other cases, without having to see if there's a safe means of retreat. But otherwise, like in, you know, out on the street, people are supposed to, if there is a safe line of retreat, to retreat before using deadly force. This bill would allow you to use deadly force without having to retreat any place a person has a legal right to be. So there was a state prosecutor who spoke passionately against the measure, saying it was going to make it a lot harder for him to do his job putting murderers behind bars, that everyone was going to invoke self-defense, and it would be more difficult to prove these cases. And just briefly, 2 years ago, when it was under Governor Sean Parnell, his Department of Law, under then Attorney General Dan Sullivan, opposed the measure, also quite strongly and on these same grounds, saying that it would make it more difficult to prosecute murders. But now the administration is for the bill.
Okay, we're about to run out of time, but Sean, before we do, federal court officials are talking about closing Alaska courthouses, except perhaps here in Anchorage.
Yeah, this is something Senator Lisa Murkowski is railing against. Think about what that would mean. The federal building in Fairbanks, for instance, houses the courthouse, as does the Anchorage one. So you'd still have the building. You'd still have all the costs that go associated with running that building. You just move I think there's two little tiny courtrooms there. Move all that business down to Anchorage, and then, of course, you're going to have to accommodate all that business, people who have business with the federal court.
You're going to have to move all these felons when they come down.
Yeah, if you're in Barrow, you got to come to Anchorage now. So she's trying to see if she can stop that, and, in this age of cost-cutting, who knows?
Speaking of stop that, our lack of time is stopping us. Thank you for joining us here on Alaska Edition. See you next week.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.